I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke, with my social media sidekick, Bree Ripley. This is The Record. U.S. immigration policy is spinning like a roulette wheel. It began when the Trump administration announced a zero-tolerance policy on illegal immigrants and began separating children from parents coming across the border with Mexico. After fiercely defending the policy and blaming the separations on Democrats, Trump reversed himself yesterday, signing an executive order to stop the separation of parents from children as they cross the U.S. border. So how's this all playing out here in Washington State? Well, I talked to Washington Governor Jay Inslee about that 45 minutes ago. Governor Inslee, you've announced that Washington State is suing the Trump administration over its family separation policy, but this policy seems to be spinning in all different directions. What's the basis of the lawsuit?
Well, I think the chaos and unpredictability of this administration that has totally bollocked up this situation is rationale enough of why we have to have the judicial system to protect both our Constitution and these children. And we have demonstrated time and time again that this rogue and chaotic administration needs to have the semblance of order and fairness and equity that is given to us by the protection of the judicial system. And is also necessary here because I think we have to understand that although Donald Trump held up this piece of paper the other day, it's essentially meaningless. I think what we've learned is that this president, his misrepresentation, his den of deceit that he's built in the White House means that you have to be vigilant about your rights or you will lose them. So we have to have judicial protection here, and I think we're responsible in that regard. Now, the other thing that we've learned in the last week is that there is virtually nothing that Donald Trump will not lie about. This is a propaganda machine he has built. He lied about how he started this policy. He lied about whether or not he could solve it with the signature of his pen. He lied about who was responsible for it. And so when you have a president who's so dedicated to propaganda rather than sharing the truth with citizens, our country deserves protection against this, and it deserves better. And we're going to do all we can to protect the Constitution.
Governor Inslee, tell us more about what we know about the number of children separated from their parents who are in Washington State. Does the state know where they are, and what can they do about this?
We do. We have looked at their situation. I've directed our Department of Social Health Services to investigate their situation. They have been out there and have talked to the children and their situation. And so we're aware of that, and there may be others as well. We are totally dissatisfied with the federal government's absolute total lack of transparency to give us information about these children in the first instance. Their absent total ignoring all repeated requests for information. I've written a letter with Attorney General Bob Ferguson. It has been ignored by the federal government. And that's a heck of a note. When you know the federal government refused to answer simple questions from the governor of the state about something that's very important. And it just shows you why it's so difficult to deal with this administration. And so we need to have aggressive, appropriate judicial action. I'm glad we have an attorney general who's been successful on multiple occasions already. And I think we're doing the right thing to protect these children. Again, it's the U.S. Constitution, and we have to remain vigilant, because we are only a tweet away from disaster on any policy given this president.
You mentioned the legal system. You've approved $1.2 million for legal services and representation to immigrants and refugees who are destitute. Will that money be enough to meet the legal needs of destitute immigrants and refugees in our state?
I don't know the answer to that, but it's what we had available. I put in $200,000 of our emergency reserve. The legislature had already appropriated before this child separation debacle occurred $1 million so that people would have the ability for the law to be enforced. We just think the law should be enforced. That's what we're asking for here. And that can't happen when people don't have access to the courts, when they don't have a lawyer. It's pretty amazing. People are shocked when I tell them this, but right now, the Trump administration could put anybody in jail in America and claim that they violated immigrant rules, and you don't have access to a lawyer unless you can pay one yourself. And what we find out is when people seeking asylum do have a lawyer, the chances of success goes up tenfold. which means to me that there's a lot of cases that appropriately we need a lawyer to get to the right decision. And I want to reiterate, these are people who legally have the right to be in this country frequently. We have a long-established principle of asylum. Both Republican presidents and Democratic presidents have protected it. It's been an American tradition for over 100 years. And now to try to short-circuit that and essentially act illegally, as the Trump administration is, to subvert that concept of asylum for people who have separate gang rapes and murder from other places. These are the victims of gangs. But President Trump keeps talking about all the people here who, you know, were born in a different country from south of the border are gang members. No, these are people who are victims of the gang that he doesn't want to even have the chance in a legitimate way to have a day in court to seek asylum. That's what this is about. It was an effort to terrorize children and families, to hold them hostage, to intentionally inflict willful child abuse on these children, because he doesn't want people to even have a hearing to determine whether they're legally appropriately entitled to asylum. That's what this whole thing was about, and the country has revolted against it.
I'm speaking to Washington Governor Jay Inslee. I understand the Trump administration has requested of several governors to deploy their National Guard troops to the border with Mexico. Have you gotten that request from the Trump administration?
We had informal requests to see if we would be amenable to that, and we, through our National Guard, told them that we would not. We need the helicopters here to fight forest fires. We have a huge risk of giant forest fires hit again this year. We need them here to take care of Wenatchee and OMAC, and they appropriately needed to stay here. And given how they have been so cruel, uncivil, and have not followed the law, we're not going to have our helicopters given to them. I'll just tell you, look, if we give them the helicopters and Donald Trump says, I'll give them back to you in 30 days, you can't trust that. You can't trust us and tells you what time of the day it is. So, no, we're not to send our helicopters south. They need to stay here and fight fires.
Governor Inslee, you mentioned that one thing the state is doing is putting money into emergency funding for legal help for some of these folks. But at the end of the day, it's immigration is a national policy. It's not a state policy. What else can you do when it comes to influencing this policy that's affecting so many people trying to come into this country?
Well, one thing we're doing is we're speaking out, and I think that the last few days have demonstrated the importance for all Americans to speak out, Republicans and Democrats alike. And you saw a situation where Donald Trump finally folded like a cheap suit when he was encountered with Republican voices who joined Democrats and independents and expressing the thought that this was not the best America could do. And when people spoke out, we were successful in changing that and exposing the lies of Donald Trump, who lied for 2 weeks about this whole policy. So when people speak up in itself, that's important. I encourage everybody to do that. But we are seeking protection, as we have for Washingtonians and the Constitution, in judicial action. We are doing that. As you indicated, we are trying to give people the right to have access to the courts through a lawyer. We are also investigating the condition of these specific children through the Department of Social Services. Now, their hands are a little bit tied because those children are not in our custody. So, but we are doing what we can to protect them in that regard. But I got to say, look, the ultimate solution to this is having people in office who will stand up to Donald Trump. And people need to be put in office who will do that.
Governor Jay Inslee, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Good luck.
It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Stay tuned. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke on this first day of summer. It's got us thinking about summer songs. Do you have a favorite summer song? Let us know what it is and why it's your favorite summer song. Tweet at us at KUOW and Bree Ripley will check it out. The open skies have always represented limitless possibility, and perhaps for no one more so than Myra Slovak. His biography reads like a big-budget adventure film. Daredevil pilot, communist defector, hydroplane racer, and character extraordinaire with a life full of stories. He was the personal pilot of Bill Boeing. He dated starlets. but his one true love was flying, and he always found freedom in the sky. David Williams has written a new book about Slovak called Race to Freedom, and he joins me to talk about Slovak's life. Welcome, Dave. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's great to be here, Ross, on this first day of summer.
It's just an amazing story, as you tell it. He was Miroslav Slovak, born in Czechoslovakia in 1929, and he was a kid when the Nazis occupied his country. What was that like for him?
Well, first of all, Myra was just an amazing person and a great friend, and I'm honored to have been able to write his biography. He said that life under the Nazis, he kind of felt guilty because it wasn't so bad for him and his family. He lived in Slovakia, the eastern half of Czechoslovakia, which was primarily a agricultural-based economy, and his father ran a grain silo. And the Nazis needed food for their soldiers, so they cooperated very well with the Slovak population. It wasn't until one day in summer when a railroad train got diverted onto the siding that served his father's silo, and it was a cattle car, but it didn't look like the cattle cars. It didn't smell. That was one of the things he said. It didn't smell like a cattle car. It smelled really foul. And his mother quick sprung into action. His mother ran a little saloon on their property, and she grabbed all of the cigarettes that she could find and put them in a box, and then she grabbed a bunch of bread and put it in a pillowcase and had Myra fill up a bucket of water. And Myra was sort of confused. And she said, go up to the train and bribe the guards with cigarettes. Give them cigarettes and get them laughing. Make them feel like they're your friends. And then ask them, can you feed their cattle? And if they say yes, then go give the bread to the people. And he said, people?
Hmm.
What do you mean people? And she said, well, those are people, and they're headed to a really bad place. Myra's hometown was just a few miles south of the Polish border. And right on the other side of the Polish border, at the end of those railroad tracks, was Auschwitz. And we all know that Auschwitz was a death camp where a lot of Jews and undesirables, as the Nazis called them, were executed. So Myra went up to the train. He talked with the guards. He gave him cigarettes, and he finally said, well, can I feed your cattle? And one of the German officers sneered and said, those aren't cattle. Those are pigs. So Myra headed over, and he began to feed, you know, hand in bread and hand in ladles full of water to the people in the train car. And at one point, the doors were chained shut, but not tight. A little girl about 6 years old was able to stick her head out of the door. And he realized, oh my gosh, these are not soldiers. These are not old men. These are my neighbors. These are the kids that I don't see in my class anymore. These are my neighbors that I can't find anymore. This is what's going on. So he realized then there was something diabolical going on. There wasn't a lot that his family could do, but they did shortly after that. They ended up taking in two Jewish families to live in their basement for the duration of the war. And there was a little bit of discontent, if you will, that his neighbors would see that Myra's mother was serving German officers in the saloon and thought, oh, well, they're collaborators. But in fact, while they were serving officers in the saloon up above in the basement, they had two entire Jewish families hidden. Wow. And those families did survive the war, and one lives in Australia now, and the other lives in Paraguay.
We're talking about a man who became Bill Boeing's pilot and a championship hydroplane racer with Dave Williams. He's executive director of the Hydroplane and Race Boat Museum, and he's written about the man in The Race to Freedom, the Myra Slovak story. The Nazis were defeated, of course, and Myra's hometown liberated by the Russians. Myra becomes a Czech Air Force pilot and rises quickly. So he must have been a very talented pilot.
He was extremely talented, but there was also a bit of political intrigue with his rise in the Air Force so quickly. During World War II, when the Nazis took over, 700 pilots from Czechoslovakia defected and went to England and formed the Free Czech Air Force flying out of England. At the end of the war, they came home and they were welcomed like heroes, and they rose quickly and took in positions of power in the Air Force. In 1948, there was a communist coup, and the communists took over Czechoslovakia. And one of the first things the communist government did was purge the military of anybody who had any contact with the West. So that meant all, you know, 700 officers at the top got booted out. and they had to bring up the young officers as quickly as possible. So yeah, 21 years old, Myra was a captain in the Czechoslovakian Air Force.
And then he goes from the Air Force to becoming a commercial pilot. They also fired all the commercial pilots?
Yeah, after the purge of the Air Force, the communists decided to purge the airline, and another large batch of pilots were arrested, imprisoned, and let go. So the Air Force loaned their top pilots to the airline. So again, at 21, Myra found himself the captain on a commercial airliner flying. He was allowed at that point to fly all over Europe, not just within the communist bloc. He was trusted enough that he was allowed to fly into Sweden, into many of the Western airports.
So he experienced Nazism, seeing people in cattle cars. He has experienced communism and seeing these purges. So he decides that neither of these are for him. He plans a daring escape. Tell us about his escape from Czechoslovakia.
Sure. And there are a number of reasons that he felt like he needed to escape, not the least of which is that the Czech had a very powerful secret police. And if someone, a neighbor, a friend, informed on you and told the secret police that you weren't doing everything the way the government wanted, these dour men in green coats would show up in the middle of the night and arrest you, and you would never be heard from again. And there were a number of Myra's friends who were arrested that way. So Myra decides that he needs to defect, and he's working with the anti-communist underground. And at one point they say, you know, we need to come up with a code word that we can use for this operation. And he says, well, how about picnic? We'll call this, you know, picnic.
Going on a picnic.
Exactly. We can talk in public. We can say, hey, Ross, what are you going to bring on the picnic? What are you going to wear? What's the weather like? Would Tuesday be a good day for the picnic? So it became Operation Picnic. And they hadn't quite set a date that they were going to leave. The idea was Myra would smuggle three guns on board the plane. The Czech underground would book a number of passengers on that flight that were sympathetic to Myra, and they would take over the plane and divert it.
And it's important to understand here, his co-pilots were not into this defection at all. He ended up locking them out of the cockpit.
Exactly. Yes, he ends up pulling off the escape, bringing two passengers up, handing them guns, and they take over the plane. And they had to lock the co-pilot and the radio operator and the engineer in the closet. And just as an aside, once they land in Germany, finally, the engineer, as Myra is being escorted off the plane by the American MPs, the engineer sort of whispers to him, you know, you bastard, you didn't tell me. I could have brought my wife. So he ended up having the engineer had to go back because he left his wife and family behind. And he felt if Myra had warned him, he would have been able to bring his family on the plane.
And after this escape, Myra Slovak also had a ton of Soviet documents with him. So when he arrives in the West, he's welcomed with open arms. He eventually, through a series of travels, gets to the United States, and he's a trained pilot. He wants to fly an airliner here, but there's a catch.
Right. In 1948, when the communists took over, if you wanted to be an officer in the military, which you needed to be an officer to fly, you had to join the Communist Party and you had to sign an oath of loyalty to the communists. So Myra really wasn't very politically savvy. He didn't care. He just wanted to fly. So he signed the loyalty oath and he joined the Communist Party. Once he got to America, that became a problem because you have to remember this was the early 1950s.
It
was McCarthyism. And there was nothing, you know, there was nothing worse to an American at that point than a commie or a red. And Myra, even though he had defected, legally he was still a communist. And you could not become a citizen for 10 years after you had renounced your membership of the Communist Party, and you could not fly an airplane. You couldn't fly an airliner. Most importantly, you couldn't get your FCC first-class radio license, which you needed to be a pilot. So the CIA goes to work, and they do a couple of things. First of all, they figure out that something you can do without a radio license is be a crop duster. So they sent Myra over to Yakima, and he was a crop duster.
And the CIA kind of owes Myra something because of all those documents he brought from the Soviet Union.
He is sort of their their golden boy. He has brought over this huge batch of documents.
So they want to do him a solid, and they eventually get him a job as Bill Boeing's personal pilot. Here's where it connects to the Northwest.
Yes, they do. They get him a job as Boeing's pilot, and then they begin to work with Senator Magnuson, who was our great senator here for a number of years, to get a special law passed that allows Myra to get a radio operator's license while still having the membership of the Communist Party on his record. So Myra comes to Seattle. He meets the Boeings. And one of the things that just I was never really clear if it was just serendipitous or if it was actually planned by the CIA. But Bill Boeing, this is Bill Boeing Jr.
Right.
His wife, Marcy, was her last name was Czech. And as you might imagine, her family was Czechoslovakian.
Huh.
Her mother and father spoke Czech. Her mother, Blanche, cooked these fabulous Czech meals, and Myra was instantly adopted into that family as another family member. So he goes from being raised on a little farm in Czechoslovakia to being in the communist military to essentially being adopted by one of the wealthiest, most powerful families in the U.S., and he becomes sort of a surrogate Boeing.
But wait, there's more.
Yeah, and that's just the start. This is a setup for the story.
So he's in Seattle. He's flying planes for Bill Boeing, a job the CIA got him. I'm speaking with Dave Williams, executive director of the Hydroplane and Raceboat Museum, which is kind of where the connection starts to come. So he starts piloting hydroplanes, basically jets on the water. And for folks who are new to the Seattle area, maybe you could just give them a quick summary of the culture of the hydroplane here, which is
sure. Well, there are, in Seattle, first of all, you have to imagine this is long before, Pete Carroll and the Seahawks, long before the Mariners, long before the Seahawks, Sonics, Sounders, any of that. The only thing going on in Seattle at that time is Husky football. And the Seattle Rainiers playing minor league baseball out at Sick Stadium. And then Husky rowing was a big thing, too. So hydroplane racing is an old sport that actually had started back on the East Coast in the 1900s. In 1905 was the first race. And the cool thing about hydroplane racing is the winning boat got to choose where the next race would be held. So if you won the race back in on the East Coast and you lived in Seattle, you could bring the race to Seattle.
And Myra won twice, two championships.
He did. He did. In 1950, a guy from Seattle named Stan Sayers, who had a boat that was designed by a fellow from Boeing that wasn't so much a boat but was more of a plane that flew across the water, skimmed the surface, won the Gold Cup and brought the Gold Cup to Seattle in 1951. That was the first race in Seattle. There was nothing really else going on in the summertime, and it hit the city like a tidal wave. One statistic that people never believe, but it is true, in 1955, when the population of Seattle was 600,000, the Seattle Police Department estimates that 500,000 people showed up at the race course to watch the race.
It's been superseded by some other things now, but it's still a giant thing in the summertime. It is basically seafare, these hydroplane races. So the Myra Slovak story, so we're going to condense it here because there's so much to tell. So he's racing hydroplanes and winning. He's flying stunt planes in the same show. He becomes an inspirational speaker. And here's, we're sort of at the end of the interview, but I find it so interesting that he's an illegal defector. He turns into a strong American patriot. But we might think here in the Seattle context, this is a liberal person with liberal attitudes. Not necessarily true when we talk about Myra. You knew him.
Sure. Myra was a complex character, and he did so many different things. It's hard to pin down exactly how he would have felt. But I do know that he was a staunch patriot. And you find that often in the immigrant community, where people who make the active decision, I am going to become an American, I'm going to give up my home, my job, my family, and come to America and invest myself in the American system, they become very, very patriotic. And Myra was amazingly patriotic. And he did during the Vietnam era, during the anti-war era, he was virulently anti-communist. That was the worst thing in the world to him. So he didn't understand the anti-war movement.
So we imagine what the staunch anti-communist might have thought about our President Donald Trump praising the president of Russia. But on other issues, how might he have felt?
It's I've struggled with that. You know, Myra passed away 4 years ago, so he's not here to ask.
Yeah.
I know that he was a supporter of Nixon and a supporter of Reagan, because those were kind of law and order patriotic Americans.
Yeah.
Trump's involvement with the Russians would have mortified Myra, but Trump's very strong conservative Make America Great would have attracted him. And it's hard for me to, I don't want to be too much of a politician here and straddle the line, but it is hard for me to decide which way he would have fallen on this issue. I can argue either direction on that.
An amazing American character, his story, the story of Myra Slovak told in the book Race to Freedom. And David Williams, thank you so much for stopping by to tell us about it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Ross.
Dave's executive director of the Hydroplane and Race Boat Museum, in Kent. And we've just barely summarized this story. There's so much more. The starlets, the fame, et cetera, et cetera. A great read, Race to Freedom.
I could be a rambler from the Seven Dials.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's June 21st, the official start of summer, and that always gets me thinking of summer songs. So we want to find out, what's your favorite summer song? Why is it your favorite summer song? Is there a memory that comes back to you when you hear that song, or is there something about the song itself that just makes you think of summer? I'm at 206-543-5869. Give us a call. Tell us what your song is. We'll try to get it on the air. That's 206-543-5869. I'm back in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. It's summertime. I'm in the car with Billy Berry because we'll be cruising North Street in Pittsfield, Massachusetts this time of year, because that's what you did. You drove back up and down on the street to see and be seen. And Billy Berry could play that radio like an instrument. He would hit the buttons on the knob to get to the station that was playing the best possible song. The windows are down and everybody hears the song. Well, it's a new era now. There's less cruising and people aren't always listening to the radio. So that's maybe changed the songs of summer. What's your favorite song of summer? 206-543-5869. Is Summer from the new Beyonce and Jay-Z album your summer song? Is it Anything by the Beach Boys? It's not your ideal first day of summer today. It's kind of overcast, but that's not stopping us from asking about your favorite summer song. Give us a call now, 206-543-5869. And Bree Ripley took the assignment to go out on the streets right outside KUOW to talk to people about their summer songs.
I sure did. I heard from many of you. I also heard from you on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you emailed us, so thank you. And we got your voicemails as well. I put together this little, I guess it's called a Vox Pop mix.
Yes.
And I first heard from my mentor and former record producer, Arwen Nix, and here's her song.
I spent an entire summer with the Loving Spoonful song Summer in the City stuck in my head because I worked at a donut shop, and every time I would wash my hands and use the paper towel dispenser, it would go, dun, dun, and then I would rip it off and it would go, tch. So, dun, dun, and then you rip it, tch, just like the song. Dun, dun, tch, dun, dun, tch. It was a good summer.
Summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match.
My name is Ruben Mendez from the band Died. I live on the Capitol Hill neighborhood in Seattle, and my summer jam is Young Turks by Rod Stewart. It's a song that reminds me of driving around as a passenger in my friend's convertible on a nice summer evening. And yeah.
My name is Willem DeCook, and I play in the Seattle band The Westerlies. And my summer song is My Volvo by the Seattle rapper named Grinch. And the song came out the same year that I got my first car, which was a 1986 Volvo of the same make and model that the song was about. And of course, my Volvo was way too old to have a working sound system, so I have really fond memories of driving around Lake Washington in the summertime, listening to the song on a really dinky iPod dock that I had Velcroed to my dashboard. And the chorus of the song goes something like this. V-O-L-V-O, V-O-L-V-O, my Volvo.
V-O-L-V-O, V-O-L-V-O, my Volvo.
Yeah, Songs of Summer. We're at 206-543-5869. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke, talking about the songs that just make us think of summer or a particular summer. And how about you, Bree Ripley? What's your summer song?
Oh, my goodness. So I share a summer song with my dad, and also an Instagram commenter, Missy, on our Instagram said that Paradise City by Guns N' Roses is her summer song, and that is definitely the song that I listen to the most in my dad's green pickup truck driving around Linwood and the Everett area.
Awesome. I have so many. I try to have one every summer, but, you know, I'll go to the Beach Boys. I'll go to the old favorites, Surf's Up. And the album of the same name, just a wonderful summer song to hear. What's yours, and why is it your favorite summer song? Give us a call. We're at 206-543-5869. We'll jump in there and try to find that song to play for you. Give us a call at 206-543-5869. And also, you can write to us at conversation at KUOW. Right there, you can tweet at us at KUOW.
Tweets,
please. Charles R. Cross is a Seattle-based journalist, author, and editor, known for his writing on Bruce Springsteen and Kurt Cobain and Jimi Hendrix. Charles, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome, Ross.
So what makes a great summer song, first of all? Can you categorize it for us? What does it have to have?
It almost never has the word summer in it, and I would argue that. So some of the things you've named so far, I take offense to. I also take offense to the idea of listening to Paradise City and Linwood. Big surprise, those two things were connected.
Charles, but, we love having you on because you never have any opinions. You
know? No, but, okay. You know, I think there's two different ideas. There's songs that have the word summer in them.
Yes.
But there's also just the thematic idea of things you do in summer. And you referenced driving. Driving songs are always summer songs. But there's something else that's really special about the perfect summer song. They almost always have been released in August, and I will name three of the best summer songs of all time.
Okay.
That would be Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, released August 25th, 1975. That's the first time it's on a radio station. So imagine you're a teenage kid, it's a hot summer night, and you're hearing Born to Run play on your car radio in an era where you can't control what music you get exposed to. Then let's jump back. I'm not old enough for this, but the Rolling Stones' Street Fighting Man,
mm-hmm.
August 1968, one of the greatest summer songs of all time. And then let's jump forward to Seattle, summer of 1991, August 27th, Smells Like Teen Spirit is officially released to radio. So everybody hears those three iconic songs in August at the hottest part of the year, and forever they remain summer songs.
Now, I have to ask you, Charles R. Cross, why do you categorically say that great summer songs cannot include the word summer in them? That doesn't make sense to me.
There's one or two exceptions. Jonathan Richman with his song, That Summer Feeling, it's
love
a great
song.
Summer song.
Yes.
But it's so direct and so literal. I think great songs are never literal. I think they always have multiple meanings with multiple listeners. And that's why people can relate to them over such a wide spectrum. When they're very literal and they say Valentine's Day, it just doesn't ring true as a love song. Whereas a song about a broken heart, Adele's song Rolling in the Deep, which isn't about Valentine's Day but could be, is the best Valentine's Day song of all time.
But surely you'd make an exception for Hot Town, Summer in the City, Back of My Neck Getting Dirty and Gritty.
I sort of disagree. I think the Loving Spoonful's Couldn't This Be Magic is a better summer song because the melodic chords, the more upbeat, to me, speak summer in a way that Hot Time, Summer in the City kind of doesn't. Alice Cooper, School's Out, worst summer song of all time. But it's one that every radio station played in the last week. But it's just not good. Paradise City, you know, in the bottom 1,000 of all songs ever written. But put on Street Fighting Man, you hear those chords before Mick even sings a word. You're in the middle of summer. But I'll read you the top seven songs on my summer playlist, which are ones we've not even talked about.
Okay.
Bobby Womack, Across 110th Street.
Oh, yeah.
M. Ward from Portland, For Beginners. Soundgarden, Fell on Back, Black Days. The Ramones, The KKK Took My Baby Away, The Pretenders, Back on the Chain Gang, Willie Mitchell, Everything's Gonna Be All Right, and John Lennon, Instant Karma. Those are my top summer songs on my playlist.
What are yours? We're at 206-543-5869. Give us a call. Tell us your song and why it's your favorite summer song. That's 206-543-5869. Charles, stay with us. We got this call earlier today. I want you to listen to it.
This is Patrick in Renton. Definitely have to say Summertime by the Fresh Prince. Lots of fun during the 80s and early 90s, actually doing exactly the same thing that he was talking about during the song. Polishing up the car, showing off, and trying to get that ever-loving summer romance. Acting with a pen and pad, I compose this rhyme to hit you and to get you equipped for the summertime.
Charles R. Cross, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Does that work for you?
It does not. And, you know, music is very personal. And I was joking with Bree, really, with about Paradise City.
Uh-huh.
You know, whatever you love, you love. But I would jump back and go to, let's take Sir Mix-a-Lot over the Fresh Prince 1,000 times. Posse on Broadway, Baby Got Back. Summertime is the songs that you want to play with your windows down. And any song that's great with your windows completely down is a great summer song.
Amen. Charles R. Cross, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to
You're
us
welcome,
and have a terrific
right.
summer.
You got it.
I'm taking your calls at 206-543-5869. And our theme, pretty simple, your summer song and why it's your summer song. Let's go to the phones. We have Jan on the line. Jan, tell us what your favorite summer song is and why.
Definitely disagreeing with your guest because the best
a lot of us are
of all time is School's Out for the Summer. And having taught for 39 years, the moment the kids drove away on the bus, we would play that as loud as we could. And I think I probably speak for every teacher. That's got to be the best.
You know, I just realized it seems kind of obvious in retrospect, but summer for much of our lives means school's over. I mean, that's the whole point of summer is that it's not
exactly.
school year. Yeah.
And true, you only have to play it once, and then summer's ready to start.
Would you sing a verse for us?
No.
All right, Jan, thanks for calling.
Take care.
206-543-5869. Give us a call with your favorite song of summer. Tell us what it is and why it's your favorite song for summer. Now, when I suggest California Girls as a great summer song, you may think Beach Boys. Record producer Allison Brusek thinks Katy Perry. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We're collecting your favorite songs of summer, 206-543-5869. What's the song? Why is it your summer song? 206-543-5869. Songs of Summer, 206-543-5869. Summer just upon us today, in fact, the first day of summer. And maybe there's been a summer romance that stuck with you because there was a song that was connected to that romance. Maybe it has to do with school. Maybe it has to do with the beach or the sunshine. We're not going to adhere to Charles R. Cross's rules that the best summer songs do not have the word summer in it. We're just not going along with that. 206-543-5869. Give us a phone call with your thoughts on what the best song of summer is for you. And I think Charles mentioned this song a little bit earlier. Let's see if we can get to it here. No, we can't. But he was talking about Bruce Springsteen songs, and he said the characteristic of a summer song is that you hear it when you're riding in a car. And there's some truth to that, because the notion of you roll down your window and you're jamming with your summer song and cranking it up, and so is the person in the next car. All of a sudden, it's all around you, that kind of universality to it. And cars, window rolled down. Now, a classic summer song, but I'm sure there are many of you listening who go, oh yeah, Bruce Springsteen, ho-hum. You've got something more contemporary that you'd like to add. 206-543-5869. Let's go to Jason. Jason, thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. Do you want to hear my song?
I do.
It's called Cake by the Ocean by DNCE. It's just got a great summer vibe. The music video is filmed on the beach. It's one of those songs, again, just like you said, you want to roll the window down, crank it, and you can get people on the sidewalks dancing along with you. It's awesome.
And can you remember when you first heard that song?
Well, I think it was last summer, yeah, because, I mean, it came out, I believe it came out last summer or maybe the summer before, but, yeah, I remember hearing it for the first time and just driving around Seattle cranking it. It was great.
We can hear that in a moment, right, Bern? We're going to hear that in a moment, but I want you to tell me a little bit more about it. Do you always have a summer song? Is this your just current summer song? Have you had past summer songs?
Yeah, that's probably my current. I mean, I don't know if I have one right now. Also, I'm trying to think if there's one a more, you know, historic that I can think of, but that's the one I can think of right now.
The funny thing about the current summer songs is it pushes all those other summer songs out of your head.
Out of your mind. Yeah, exactly.
It's immediate gratification. 206-543-5869. Tell us what your song of summer is, the song that was important to you some summertime, or the song that meant something to you for some reason or another. Maybe it's the particular lyrics or the particular time. Let's hear that song that Jason just mentioned.
See you walking around. Waste time with the masterpiece, to waste time with the masterpiece. You should be rolling with me, you should be rolling with me. You're a real life fantasy, you're a real life fantasy. But you're moving so carefully, let's start living dangerously. Talk to me, baby.
Yeah, our heads are bobbing here, and I think that might be one characteristic of a summer song. Your head's kind of bobbing back and forth. 206-543-5869. If you just joined us, I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. And we're talking today about summer songs that really kind of stick with you for some particular reason. We're asking you to tweet at KUOW.org. Bree Ripley, you've been paying attention to what people are saying on the Twitter.
Yes, I have. So Amanda in Seattle says, one of mine is Chicago, Saturday in the Park. And I also hit up Austin Jenkins, asked him what he considers to be his summer song. It's Kenny Chesney's Summertime, though he adds that sometimes he calls him Kenny Cheesy. He just loves it, though.
Great. What's yours? 206-543-5869. Tell us what it is. We can probably find it and even play a little bit of it to get your head bobbing. Let's go to Ron, who joins us on the line now. Ron, thanks for taking the time to call us. What's your summer song?
Well, I just had to say that I can agree and disagree with your guest, because as much as he doesn't like summertime, personally, he did say that it's everybody's personal choice what their favorite is. And my girls were 1 and 3 years old at the time. They're 28 and 30 now. But whenever Summertime came on in 1991 when it was released, my 3-year-old would start dancing around, And that's what I remember about Summer. It was just her her having a great time when that song first came out.
And tell me the song again.
Yeah, Summertime. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
And
fantastic.
Now, but when you play that song for them today, do they go, "Oh, Dad"?
I haven't had the chance, but now that I've heard about it on this show, I'm going to, because I know for a fact my oldest daughter would remember it. It was just one of those songs that I was trying to think of something from when I was young, but it immediately went to that because of my girls.
Sure.
It was great to hear a bit of it because I haven't heard it in years. It's not something that they just play.
As an older daughter myself, I certainly remember the songs that my dad played for me. I'm sure she will.
There you go.
So yeah. This is another category of summer songs. Thanks for bringing that up. The summer songs that your parents played for you. 206-543-5869. Do they stick in your head, even if they just stick in your head in kind of a bad way? What was that hokey song that was a big hit at one time? Summertime, summertime, summertime. That was the entire lyric. Summertime, summertime, summertime. Went on forever. John joins us now. John, thanks for taking a moment to tell us about your favorite summer song. What is it?
In 1969, I turned 16 years old, and that summer, Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone came out. I'll be 65 tomorrow, so it's like kind of appropriate, you know, I thought I'd call, you know, let you know.
Thanks for letting us know about that, John. Thanks for calling in.
End of the spring, and here she comes back. High, 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 high there. Them summer days, those summer days. That's when I have most of my
Sly and the Family Stone. That just says sunshine to me. Let's go next to another phone call. We're at 206-543-5869, getting your nominations for the best summer song that you know about and why. Is there a story attached to that? You played it for your kids. Something was going on in your life at the time that imprinted that in your mind. We've got Drew on the line, and you can join us too. We got a couple more minutes at 206-543-5869. Drew, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What's your summer song?
That'd be Sublime, Summertime, Doing Time, released in 1996.
And what about that song really is something that really connects with you?
Just growing up in California, high school, you know, summertime was easy when you were a kid. Just reminds me of good times, you know, cruising in the summer with my friends and enjoying it while it lasted.
Let's enjoy it.
She treats me like a unlocked down like a penitentiary. She spreads her loving all over, and when she gets home, there's none left for me.
Summer songs. Julie on Facebook said, "Good Day Sunshine" by the Beatles. She says, "It always makes me feel like it's a sunny day, even when it's not." Lisa is joining us. Lisa, your summer song.
Hi. My summer song is Joker by Steve Miller Band.
And why does that evoke summer to you?
Well, to me, it brings back so many memories. I grew up in Spokane,
mm-hmm.
and I was in high school in the early 90s. And, you know, it took a while before grunge kind of made its way over to the east side of the mountains in full force.
Mm-hmm.
And so we relied on Steve Miller Band, and it was party, party, party.
All right, let's hear it. Thanks for your call.
Some people call me the space cowboy. Yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice. Because I speak of the pompous of love. People talk about me, baby. Say your wrong, doing your wrong. Well, don't you worry, baby, don't worry.
Steve Miller, who's done his time in the Northwest. I think we got time for one more phone call in our shout out for the song of summer that really sticks with you. Marla's on the line. Marla, what's yours?
Hi. My song is Funky Town. It's a disco song. And the reason I'm mentioning it, I don't know who wrote it or sings it, but we used to drive down to the Baskin and Robbins with my friend Trans Am, and we'd roll down the windows and open the sunroof and sing and scream out the window.
Funky Town.
And the ice cream place.
Bernard's just been looking this up, and Bernard, who does it?
It says Lips Incorporated.
All right, Funky Town. It's Funky Town here on the record on KUOW. Tonight, Week in Review with Bill Radke is going to be recording the show that'll be on tomorrow at noon. If you'd like to be there, it's at the Bellevue Art Museum at 7:30. To guarantee a seat, go to kuow.org events and you can sign up. That's our show for today, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Ross Reynolds. Stick around.